Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. The woodland caribou is a threatened species in Alberta, so it's been under the scientific microscope for a number of years. One person tramping around the woods collecting the fur of wolves that prey on caribou is David Latham, a PhD candidate at the University of Alberta. And John McDougall looks back at the performance of the Alberta Research Council over the last year, and he believes this scientific agency is ready to take on the world market when it comes to research and technology commercialization. And the Provincial Museum is dipping into the dandy world of DNA with its latest exhibit, The G in Genome. Dr. Randy Johnston of Genome Prairie talks about this display and the growing importance of genomics to our economy. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Alberta's woodland caribou have never existed in great numbers, so it doesn't take much to threaten their survival. Development in the north has added new pressures as seismic lines and cut blocks open greater access to predators such as wolves. For several years, scientists have been studying the woodland caribou to come up with better management tools for energy and forestry companies. One of those researchers is David Latham, a PhD candidate at the University of Alberta. Originally from New Zealand, David has been traveling across northeastern Alberta, collecting bits of fur from wolves and coyotes. The objective is to get a better understanding of the predator-prey relationship with woodland caribou.
I am trying to sample predators via a hair removal method. So we're setting up barbed wire hair sites, which are baited in the middle, and the predators then enter these, and a small amount of hair is removed from them. So we can identify the hair morphologically, or we can do DNA analysis on that. And in winter, we also have the added benefit of being able to identify the predators via tracks left in the snow. Now, on top of that, I'm looking at predators within a number of different areas out there. So actual core peatland areas, so the more swampy area where the caribou are located, along rivers and streams, and on seismic cut lines, access ways and that sort of thing, the man-made linear features out there. And I'm also comparing that to the more traditional areas where we know predators are common, which is the upland habitat, which is sort of adjacent to this peatland complex.
Now, why would you have to use like a hair trap? I don't know if that's the correct term, instead of just capturing the wolves and putting collars on them.
Well, in many ways, it's better to get some sort of an idea of habitat use by collaring the wolves or the coyote or whatever. However, it's notoriously difficult to catch these things. There have been previous studies which have attempted to do that. However, there's a bit of a gap in our knowledge. We really have not managed to isolate what is happening within the more core areas of these caribou ranges. We're answering the questions around the periphery of these ranges more. And this is probably because wolves are more abundant in these areas, but there are still wolves within the core area of the caribou range, but they just are not as abundant, and we're having difficulty catching them to answer these questions. So by using this hair snare method, we can just get some sort of an idea what is out there without actually having to capture the wolves. So it's just a little bit more simple, really.
How large an area are you looking at?
It's about 20,000 square kilometres, covering the west side of the Athabasca River Range and adjacent upland habitat. So it's a pretty large area.
You're not walking that, are you?
I'm walking a lot of it. Not all of it, but a lot of it.
What are some of the things that you've found out?
We found out so far that coyotes are more abundant out there than we would initially have. We initially thought. Essentially, the whole area appears to be saturated with coyotes. Now, they are traditionally not a predator of this landscape. They have extended their range up there. And it's widely known that coyotes are found over all of Alberta, but we were unsure to what extent they'd managed to extend their range into the more remote areas of the boreal forest. However, from this initial work, it appears that they have essentially managed to invade all of my study area anyway, so they've really covered it a lot. We're also finding that bears are right out in the middle of the peatland area, and that wolves are more common out in the peatland area than we had initially thought. Now, that's just what preliminary analyses would suggest, so there's still a lot of work to go there, but it would definitely appear as though they are more common out there than we had initially thought.
So you've got more wolves, you've got an invasion of coyotes into that area. What is that doing to the notions of what the real predator-prey relationship is?
Well, it's not just those factors. It's also the primary one I think we're concerned with is that the predator-prey dynamics are being upset by the linear features that are out there, that it could be enhancing the predator's capability of getting around this area, and if they're able to access these areas more quickly and efficiently than they were in the past, then it's likely that their hunting is going to be greatly improved, their hunting ability, and this is obviously going to have deleterious effects for the caribou. So that's our main concern. What exactly is happening with the coyotes, we don't know. They could be important in the in respect to calf predation, but we're unsure if that's all speculation at the moment. The potential is there for that sort of thing at the moment, but it's really, we just think that there could be an increased use of these linear features, and that could be really stacking the odds against the caribou.
Now the linear features, that seismic lines and pipelines.
Pipelines and roads and all of these things, we're definitely finding that there is a lot of use by wolves, bears and coyotes on these features. And in winter, we have actually found that those roads that are maintained are getting the most use. So in other words, if they've had the snow graded off them, they're getting more use than those roads that have not had the... which makes sense. I mean, I don't enjoy walking along a road that has deep snow on it either, so... The coyotes and the wolves are doing the same thing.
Now that you've spent the 2 years in the field and you've got all of this stuff together, what else are you finding out?
Well, the system is complex in other ways. There have been a number of people, land managers, oil and gas guys, and a lot of academics that have spoken about the increase in white-tailed deer and what impact this will be having on the system, particularly... from the western side of this caribou range, white-tailed deer numbers are really increasing, particularly with the number of large cut blocks out there. And it appears as though wolves are responding to this increase in white-tailed deer, and their numbers are increasing. In fact, I've heard estimates of pack sizes of 25 out there, of 25 wolves, and it's a pretty large pack. So it's possible that this increase in wolves is spilling over and having negative effects in the caribou range, particularly when you take into consideration this increase in man-made features out there like roads and seismic lines, which we're finding predators are using more. So the combination of these two things, an increase in predators out there and their enhanced hunting efficiency via these linear features, it's quite possible that it's creating more encounters with caribou, and that there's going to be an increased likelihood of the wolves actually killing the caribou because of it.
So even though they have an alternate prey, like they could go after the deer because there's more deer, they're still ending up going after the caribou as well?
Well, it could be that they're not even targeting the caribou. It's just that there is an increased likelihood of encountering them, even if it's only by chance. Whether they're actually targeting the caribou or not, we're unsure. There is also moose in the system. Previous studies have found that moose tend to be spatially separated from the caribou, but this is a grey area in some bits of this range, and caribou and moose are found together in some areas. So perhaps the prey density is high enough there to make it worthwhile to the predators to actually hunt these species together.
Well, it sounds like everything's just getting more and more complex and complicated. What are you going to do with everything that you found out now? Where does this go?
Well, ultimately, it's going to go to the managers out there. We need to find some way of managing the predators, as they seem to be the most, the largest mortality factor out there for the caribou. So ultimately, if we want to do something to really manage and aid the caribou populations out there, we need to control the predators in some way. One option that has been put forward is a controversial one. It's actually predator removal. There are other suggestions that have been put forward, like excluding the predators from the caribou range or impeding their movement along linear features out in the range. So just trying to make it more difficult for them to get around this range as efficiently. So I'm hoping that this data that I've collected will be helpful in aiding any of those management scenarios.
Thank you very much, Dave.
You're welcome.
That was David Latham, a PhD candidate in biological sciences at the University of Alberta. He's working under Dr. Stan Booten in the Integrated Landscape Management Program. The Alberta Research Council has released its annual report, which gave me an opportunity to stop by and see John McDougall. As the president of the Alberta Research Council, John has captained this important 83-year-old institution through some of its most challenging times. The council has had to reinvent itself as a profit-making business entity, and it now appears ready to not only take on the science and technology market of Alberta, but also the world.
Well, of course, we continue to be very interested in energy and life sciences primarily. But what we've recognized is that if we're going to be good, the areas we're going to work in, we have to be, if not a world leader, we certainly at least have to be world class, because technology these days is that. And much of what we do involves working with others to try to put technology solutions together for our customers. And if we're not among the best, then other people don't want to talk to us and work with us.
What have been the challenges that you've had to face this year?
Well, some of the major things that we've been doing, of course, if you look, you'll see that increasingly our revenues come from contract work as opposed to direct grant support from governments. And as we move into sort of a market space, the dynamics of how you generate revenues, how you run a business, how you make sure your costs are in line with your revenues and so on are very different than they are if someone hands you essentially your budget at the beginning of the year and says don't overspend it. So simply on basic skill sets, we need people who can manage rather than administer, if I can use that terminology. Associated with that, we've got to get a lot better at understanding market opportunities, looking out, seeing what the problems are, shaping potential solutions, and then putting them in front of people in ways that they can understand and see value in, and then convince them, of course, that we're the ones who can help generate that value for them. So that's a different kind of an exercise. Associated with that, if we're going to run the business where now our revenues and our expenses have to be kind of managed together, we need better business processes. So we've changed our management information systems. We've changed the accountability and reporting systems. We've changed the way we manage projects. So we've got people changes. We've got business process changes. We've got marketing changes. And then, of course, we want people to know all of this. So we've also got issues associated with branding and identity and how we get into the marketplace. It's a big, big, big change.
Is the Alberta Science and Technology market a big enough market for the Research Council if you have to make a business out of this?
Well, it's an interesting, that's a very, very interesting question, actually, because our obvious initial answer would be no. But you have to be careful when you say that. Today, for example, in the sort of the space that we're in, the ARC does roughly half of all the outsourced work that industry commissions in research and development. So we're not likely going to sort of win by trying to take more of that market, if I can put it that way. So that would tell us then we should go beyond, because Alberta's market is incredibly small in global terms. It's sort of a fraction of 1%. So there's huge opportunities out there. Now, on the other hand, our job is to try to help Alberta be successful. So we always want to be thinking about what we can do to make Alberta successful. And research and development is a funny business because it's not the same kind of a market as a lot of other things. It's not, for example, like you need to wash your clothes once a week sort of thing. It's more if I can make you more successful. If I can get you to do things you didn't used to do before, I can, in fact, increase your market. And by increasing your market, I can increase my market, and so on. So they're sort of in lockstep. The challenge, of course, is that in order for us to do our job, the fundamental capabilities we've got to bring together are people and facilities. And we can only bring those together if we can generate enough revenues to pay the costs, or if somebody wants to invest in putting them in place. And that's where the challenge is. So we're in this really funny sort of chicken and egg problem, where if we're doing good things, we're helping to grow our own market, in a sense, by creating opportunities that didn't exist, as opposed to simply taking a share of market from somebody else. So it's a very strange business in that respect. There is, though, still the potential in the bigger world to take business from others and to bring it to Alberta so that it's done here and then make us a center of excellence that we can use as a way to transfer capability, again, into the local economy, make them more successful, grow that market, and so on. So it's one of the most complex businesses, actually, that we've certainly that I've ever been involved with.
Well, it's still all based on the science and technology and the research and the commercialization that goes on here. What are some of the successes that you've had this year in that science and technology area?
Well, we have some really interesting things going on. Of course, energy has always been one of the Research Council's strong points and continues to be. We're very excited about some of the new recovery technologies that are emerging that will help us enhance the recovery, particularly of our heavier oil and oil sands deposits. These are new technologies or new approaches to old technologies that have the potential to double or perhaps triple recovery, and that's a huge value. We're really excited about what's going on in the environmental side, particularly in our waste management areas. We have this thing called IMUS, this Integrated Manure Utilization System, that I know has been talked about on your program from time to time. Sort of the full-scale pilot plant is under construction as we speak, and will probably be starting up in the fairly near future. That has huge potential. Actually, someone was pointing out to me that if we could take advantage of the waste from Alberta's livestock industry, that it's the equivalent of 5,000 megawatts of power. So it's enormous. That's half of Alberta's power generation, or almost half of Alberta's power generating capacity today. So that's pretty exciting. We've got some really neat stuff going on in fuel cells and in what we call engineered wood products and so on. So we're very excited about the future, actually.
What's around the corner? Any hints?
Well, I'm sort of alluding to that, I guess, as we go. But the big area I think that we and the province both have to get our minds around is the life science agenda and find an area or two where we're really going to be able to build world-class capabilities in Alberta, capabilities that will actually stay here. This new IFASA, the Integrated Food and Agricultural Science thing, I think is the proper name for it. which is going to bring together the capabilities of the players in agriculture and food, including us, is, again, I think, trying to build a base so that Alberta gets way beyond being just a primary agriculture producer. And I think, as we've seen with things like BSE and so on, if we don't move down those paths, we're always going to be at risk. So I'm very excited about that, too.
Thank you very much, John.
Cheryl, it's always good to talk to you.
That was John McDougall, president of the Alberta Research Council. If you're having trouble figuring out the acrobatics behind the double helix, well, it's time to drop by the Provincial Museum. That's where you'll find a great new exhibit called the G in Genome. This traveling exhibit is sponsored in part by Genome Prairie, and I had the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Randy Johnston, the president of Genome Prairie and a cancer researcher with the University of Calgary, at the opening of the exhibit.
Genomics is a very new discipline. It begins with the study of the DNA molecule, which of course provides the hereditary basis for life, but it goes on from there as well to look at the products of the genome, which are the protein molecules that are the, you could say, the engines or the machines of a cell, how they're assembled to make a cell, and then how cells come to form tissues and organs, and eventually the whole organism. So it starts with a molecule of DNA and goes all the way to the organism and even eventually to the environmental interactions as well.
How important is this field of study to us now?
The study of genomics and all that follows from that, I think, is emerging as one of the most exciting areas of research in science today, but also of technology application. We're seeing the development of biotechnology companies across Canada and around the world. It's an increasingly important economic factor in our society, but especially it's having a huge impact on our medical system through the development of new diagnostic aids and therapeutic tools, and also in our studies of fisheries and forestry and agriculture and many other industrial areas in our economy.
Why is that?
Well, really, the study of genomics, the DNA molecules and everything that follows, really is at the core of our understanding of the life sciences. And that's emerging as one of the most important aspects of our entire structure of our society and of our economy.
You're the head of Genome Prairie. What is Genome Prairie?
Genome Prairie was established about 3 years ago. It's part of a Canada-wide initiative. The umbrella group is called Genome Canada. It's federally sponsored initially, but we have these geographic regions across the country. So there's a Genome British Columbia, a Genome Prairie, one in Ontario, Quebec, and Atlantic Canada. And each of us is responsible for coordinating the research and development of activities of the scientists within our geographic domains. We want to make sure that the benefits of this science and technology accrue to the regions, to the citizens of those areas.
There's so much competition in scientific research now, and just like economics, science is global in the sense of the collaborations between researchers and countries and that. Where do the researchers in Canada or even in Alberta fit within the total scheme of things when it comes to genomics and genomic research?
What we find is that scientists around the world are collaborating on this area of genomics research. The data that we generate, the genomic sequences, etc., are published in publicly available computer databases, so anybody with a computer access in the world can look at, for example, the human DNA sequence or the mouse DNA sequence or various plants that have been sequenced and all of that together. So that part of it is completely public. And of course, then biotechnology or pharmaceutical industries get interested in it, and they develop the products, and that's where the competition comes in, as it should, because they're trying to develop the best products that will be useful for humankind. Where Canada fits in the world scene, I think, is really quite well. We've got some of the best researchers in the world in genomics and biotechnology in this country, and actually we have the second highest number of biotechnology companies in the world located right here in Canada. Number one, of course, is the United States. There are roughly 4,000 or 5,000 biotechnology companies in the U.S. Canada is second. We have about just over 400 companies. Third would be Britain with about 300. And there are other countries around the world go down from there. So actually, we're doing really quite well. As a country, we have decided to invest in this area of research and development, and we are now beginning to see the fruits of that investment.
We're here today at the opening of a display called the Gee and Genome, which is at the Provincial Museum of Alberta for the next few months. Why have you been involved in this this museum exhibit?
Well, Genome Prairie and Genome Canada, indeed all of the regional genome centers across the country, developed a partnership with the Canadian Institutes of Health Research and the Museum of Nature to create a traveling exhibit called the GN Genome. It's going across the country. Right now it's located here in Edmonton as part of its travels across the prairie provinces. And the intent of this is to help the public become aware of what it is we're trying to accomplish, why it's exciting, why it's already having an impact on our lives, and especially what are the kinds of potential developments that we're going to see in the future. It's oriented to the kid in all of us, from elementary school kids all the way to the 80-year-old child who is interested and excited about the potential of technology and research and development. It's a hands-on exhibit. It's lots of fun. People who come here really enjoy it. And it's part of our strategy to try to bring awareness and education to the citizenry across this country.
It is a very interactive display, and I can hear little beeps and things going off in the background. What are some of the things that stand out for you in this? What are your favorite parts?
I think what I like is that it's really quite comprehensive. It starts, as you enter the exhibit, with a display of who are the researchers in the country, in Canada, that have led to the developments that we're so excited about. And then it takes you into the structure of the DNA molecule and proteins and cells, and it builds it all the way up to the whole organism, to the environment, to the industrial applications, etc. So in a few hundred square feet, what you have is a micro-encapsulation of the entire life sciences technology sphere, and it's something that you can just sink your teeth into and enjoy it with all of these interactive exhibits. So it's really interesting and exciting at the same time.
Thank you very much.
You're most welcome. Thank you for joining us.
That was Dr. Randy Johnston, president of Genome Prairie and a cancer researcher at the University of Calgary. You can catch the G and Genome exhibit at the Provincial Museum. It's here until October. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Ducks Unlimited Canada, the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Ingenuity, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Research Council, the Science Alberta Foundation, and Alberta Conservation Association. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.